We have seen the goal of the yoga of knowledge as propounded by Sri Aurobindo. The goal of the Gnostic consciousness leading to a status in the bliss consciousness. In fact, the peaks of the Gnostic consciousness fade into the heights or the seas of bliss. Starting from matter, material life, Sri Aurobindo has shown how the human consciousness can culture itself grade by grade, assimilate the gains of each level, and ascend the ladder of existence till it reaches the Gnostic levels bordering on the worlds of Ananda, the bliss. And the aim he has made sufficiently clear is not only to realize and possess the divine, but also to be possessed by the divine. One realizes the objective, one realizes God, not somewhere beyond, but here on earth, in the circumstances of material life, here in the field of ignorance and evolution, the divine is to be realized and possessed. The divine is realized in this path, not in one aspect or other. One realizes the divine as the impersonal, the vast impersonality that refuses to be defined. But one also realizes the divine in his multiple personalities. Similarly, one realizes the divine in utter static passivity of poise, as also in the dynamic outpourings of his being. One realizes the divine as calm, as peace, not a static peace, but a powerful, potent peace, and equally in the multifarious activity that characterizes this manifestation of God. Second, one opens oneself to the divine consciousness, to the divine being, and allows oneself to be filled with the successive descents of God. Simultaneously, one lifts himself from the lower to the next higher level, whether it is the physical body or the life force or the mind, thought mind, or the higher levels of consciousness. One is continuously at work, making the grades in the ladder of spiritual consciousness, integrating in oneself what has gone behind and what is attained at present with an eye to the future. There is a continuous process of assimilation, of reflection, and a process of identification with the Divine. The Divine everywhere, the Divine in all aspects, the Divine coming down, oneself ascending into the heights of the Divine. These are the broad lines of the scheme worked out in the yoga of knowledge. We have not touched so far on one important distinction, and that is in the process of the yoga of knowledge. I have once before told you that one of the ancient Upanishads speaks of two kinds of knowledge, the higher knowledge and the lower knowledge. It describes all the 64 sciences, arts and sciences known to man, the intellectual man, as the lower, constituting the lower knowledge. And that by which the Divine is known, the Immutable is known, by knowing which all else is known, that is the higher knowledge. What the ancients thought of the ultimate value of the several branches of lower knowledge will be evident to you if I once again recall to you a legend in one of the Upanishads, which I believe I have recounted to you once or twice before. That is, the sage Narada, the divine singer, he approaches the divine manifestation of Sanat Kumara and tells him that he has mastered, he has known all the branches of learning open to man, but he has not been able to cross the ocean of sorrow in spite of it. He is reminded by the teacher, by the divine teacher, that what he knows is only the name of things, not the reality. He knows what he knows, only the label. And stressing upon the sheer inadequacy of the learning that he has, the teacher, so the legend goes, gives him, communicates to him the knowledge that leads him across the shore of ignorance. Now, Sri Aurobindo does not dismiss the various branches of lower knowledge superciliously. He, as everywhere, he gives due weight to what has been evolved, to what has been useful, and while pointing out their limitations, he takes care to affirm their utility at their level. Speaking in this context of the various branches of lower knowledge, art, science, psychology, philosophy, ethics, and so on, Sri Aurobindo describes how they are the starting points for the seeker. Any science, if it is honestly pursued, is bound to lead to the reality. At any rate, to the gates of reality. He describes how science, physical science, with which the modern man swears, has now come to the end of its tether in its honest pursuit of truth and is face to face with a reality that it cannot comprehend, that it cannot explain. It is on the borders of the infinite. Similarly, art, it opens the inner eye of man to the beauty, to the aesthetic value in nature, subtilizes his emotions and prepares him for a subtler life. Psychology, the science of mind, it is bound to come at a stage when it stands face to face with certain phenomena which it is unable to explain on its own basis. It develops into parapsychology. Parapsychology again leads to the borders of mysticism, philosophy. It gives us it speaks of the principles of things, and number of philosophies emphasizing the different principles of things lead the seeker, lead the honest student to the perception of the principle of principles, and so on. You take history. One studies the events that have happened in the life of humanity. One traces a line of development, whatever the checks and temporary setbacks. One sees a forward advance of consciousness, and one is forced to admit a direction, a teleology in the course of evolutionary movement. Each branch of learning, each limb of knowledge called the lower knowledge, has its utility. As long as man needs to be educated by these sciences and brought up to a level when he is ready to receive the higher knowledge, to cultivate the higher knowledge, their role is indispensable. That is why, in his voluminous writings, Sri Aurobindo has dealt with the fundamentals of the various sections of human knowledge: polity, sociology, culture, philosophy, mysticism, and so on. But everywhere he takes care to point out that these sciences and arts approach the reality from outside. At their best, they can expose the processes of things, how things happen, to the extent that the processes lend themselves to the human eye and the human intelligence, they explain. They perceive something of the reality from across a veil, the veil of senses, but they do tend towards the reality. It is when all that the lower knowledge has to provide has been provided that the stage arrives for the higher knowledge to be attempted, and the means to realize the higher knowledge of God, of the divine reality in its manifold aspect, is through yoga. Yoga is a discipline, we may call it an art, a science, but an inner art, a deeper art and a higher science, which aims to link the soul, one's own being, with the reality directly. It doesn't approach from outside, but it approaches directly. And there are three ways in which yoga attempts to arrive at the consummation of higher knowledge, which is the direct realization of the divine reality. First, purification. It doesn't need to be emphasized that in the normal working of our mind, the senses, there is so much of impurity, likes and dislikes, prejudices, preferences, conscious and unconscious, that pervert, that deviate the senses into getting interested reports, that influence the mind in judging in a biased way. These impurities, psychological impurities, when we speak of impurity in yoga, it is not so much the physical impurity, but it is the psychological impurity that is meant. When people speak of purification, when they ask me purification through food, purification of external purification, things are not put in their proper perspective. Of course, external cleanliness is necessary. A certain amount of purity in food is, physical purity in food is necessary. But what is more important is the psychological purity. Even in food, mind you, it is the psychological purity that is emphasized in the Indian tradition. There are many stories that I could tell you. How? Yogis have suffered on account of certain impure thoughts that have passed through the mind of the person who has either cooked the food or served the food. You are all certainly aware of the incident in the life of Ramakrishna Paramahamsa. He was an unassuming man, and he had been to the house of one of his rich disciples, and there they were served with some rice cakes. There were a number of people, and the head of the house, he had them served, and he himself went to attend upon other guests of his social class. As soon as the saint touched that rice cake, he started. He got burning in the whole body, and he started shivering. He didn't allow his disciples to make fuss, but he quietly slipped out, and thereafter explained that someone in the household connected with the food must have had impure thoughts. And thereafter it was verified and confirmed. Similarly, I have known of many instances in the mother's life when impurities in the activities or in the minds of the devotees and disciples in the ashram have had a deleterious effect on her body. Once, when she was found scratching her arms on the playground, someone asked her what was the matter, because she was not known to be scratching like that. She just replied, someone is indulging in sex. That is one. In another context, as you know, she was not taking much solid food for many years, and she used to take only a little grape juice in the morning for breakfast, very small tumbler. Once what happened, when the grapes arrived, they were kept in a basin under the tap for washing. And the gentleman in charge just happened to go inside to bring something. At that time, two of our boys, they passed, they looked at the grapes and they said, "What fine grapes." That is all. When those grapes were served in juice the next day to the mother, she did not touch it. She did not know. She was not told anything, but still, her being repelled, a tainted food, a food on which desire had been cast. Those boys did not mean anything. They could not help. But this is the reason why one emphasizes on psychological purity in spiritual life much more than physical purity. The first step, as I said, in attaining to the higher knowledge, in opening oneself to the higher knowledge, is purification. Purification of the mind, purification of the nerves. Each one has its different technique. Perhaps we'll come to it sometime later. Purification of the subtle body. Next, concentration. Everyone knows how our faculties are spread in 100 directions. We are never aware that we are spread out in so many diverse directions. Concentration consists in gathering all our faculties, movements, thoughts, emotions, all of them together gradually with a will, focusing them, bringing them together and fixing them on one object. It is only by this process of a compulsive marshalling of our faculties and focusing them on the object of our pursuit that we can establish a link with the object and force the object to yield its content to our perceiving, receptive, grasping consciousness. As one is purified, as the consciousness is concentrated and settles upon the reality or an aspect of reality, there is an effortless reflection of that consciousness, of that reality, in the quietude of our being. Like the moon in the placid waters, describes an image of the Upanishads. When this reflection is complete, when this concentration is at its premium, one attains an identification with the reality, a complete identification. One is no more aware of a division, of a separation between oneself and the divine. This is the object of higher knowledge. Higher knowledge is that which reveals the divine reality in itself establishes an identification and makes one one with it. We have said that the divine so realized, at any rate in this context, is not the alone, but the divine manifest in the universe, in all powers, in all values, at all levels. The divine is realized in himself, in oneself, in all things around. This is the object of the higher knowledge to which the lower knowledge prepares the way. Mother has described in many of her talks how it is indispensable for the mind to be educated, to be cultured in the ways of the intellect. Intellect does not give the final key, but it has to be stimulated. The intelligence has to be made dynamic, active, and as the brain is being developed by effort, new cells get formed, new grooves form themselves into which the higher knowledge can flow. The lower knowledge has a great use, and the higher knowledge, when it dawns, does not reject the lower avenues. It makes them part of itself, suffuses the lower branches of knowledge with its own light, and makes them so many windows or gateways of approach to the mansion of the Lord. Any questions? You mean now? I can only answer quoting a cynical remark of someone which I heard a few days ago, that now mother is nobody's property. You understand? Everyone has access to her. Everyone can talk to her, refer to her. She is given herself to everyone. Not only here, but even abroad. I have received letters from Rome, from Holland, and other countries, where they say it was never so easy. They have only to think of mother, to feel her presence, to get the word, the definite word of guidance. A lady was told, old lady from in Rome, this is not the time to weep. Look, and she said the floodgates of joy were opened. It was on the 18th of November. I suppose it is self-evident that when she has cast off the physical vesture, the consciousness spreads wide and in this case there is a great element of grace. She has deliberately held herself at the disposal of her children. Only yesterday, someone told me, who has had certain inner contact with the mother all these years, that when she looked in, she was told, I have deliberately held myself here. I have to now spread out.
In view of this, what is your reaction to the offering of flowers and incense and the presence of photographs in the construction of the Mata Mandir in the construction?
As long as it helps us to make the presence concrete to ourselves, it can be continued. When the whole structure is complete, when the full presence installs itself, all these things may be irrelevant. By that time we also would have developed enough. But I do think at this stage, we do need the support of visual representations of the purifying vibrations of incense, of which Mother speaks so highly in the prayers and meditations. They do have a great occult significance. Incense. They drive out and discourage the little elementals, the hostile spirits from establishing themselves in the atmosphere. Inertia, sloth, mischief, these things, falsehood, these forces are discouraged in the presence of light, in the presence of incense, in the presence of a photograph or something which radiates the vibrations of a higher consciousness. If we can evoke those vibrations from within ourselves, nothing else is necessary. But are we always in that condition? We don't live within ourselves. Man doesn't live alone. He is subject to so many influences, and he is not always at his best, at his highest. Always for us, not just images, photographs, not representations, not likenesses, but living symbols that touch us, that put us in touch immediately with the reality behind, with the consciousness behind. I have known mother explaining what kind of consciousness she had when a particular photograph was taken. She attached that much importance. Once she explained this particular photo, if you have any problem, if you concentrate upon it, that problem will go. But don't tell this to people, she told me. But it was too much to keep for myself. Yes, then there was one photograph, she was sitting like this, 1961-62 she had taken, she was just on his couch, she was reclining, looking. As I saw, I lost the sense of my head, that is, I felt I had no lid, and there was a sense, a kind of a experience of the infant. So when I went to her in the evening, I told mother, as soon as I saw this photograph, I felt like this. Then she laughed. She said, yes, that is precisely the consciousness in which I was when this photograph was taken. Then I wanted copies of that photograph to be made and sold. It was a color photograph. But unfortunately, the person who had the negative had spoiled it. So to make it available, I got a block made of the copy that I had, signed by mother, and included it, a color print, in one of my books, Lamps of Light. Later, sometime, I think 10 years or so afterwards, Champaklal spoke to mother once about that photograph and said the photo mother liked. 10 years after, mind you, and all people think that mother used to forget things. After 10 years, when Champaklal told, the photograph which Madhav had brought to mother and mother liked, she said, the photo which Madhav liked, she said. So he came to ask me to check up. I said, I have a recollection that mother liked it and you had taken it, but mother says that you liked it. I said, yes, mother didn't say anything, I liked it. These are all sweet memories. We don't need memories to keep her living with us. But they come and come. Yes.
In that answer that you gave to the role of Mahamandirian spiritual evolution, my notes are not clear on the part in which you said about the links that Mother established with many levels of public existence. I'll read you what I have and perhaps you could make it clear. This is clear, that the Mahamandir being a concrete expression of the Mother's consciousness and force will always stand as a reservoir of inspiration, a lighthouse radiating continually the manifestation of truth as it has been embodied in the Mother. This is put in a different tense, of course.
Mm.
What the Mother's embodiment has been to us here, the full-fledged Mahamandir will be to the whole of humanity. Now this is the part I mentioned. In the course of our life on Earth, the Mother has established links with many levels of cosmic existence.
I think you can end with humanity.
With the whole of humanity.
I think so. I think that day I must have talked something else earlier. And so the question came with the links with the different levels of consciousness. It's not so necessary. This sums up what I have said, these two sentences.
But this is very important, of our relating to the truth light, which the Mahamandir will be an instrument for bringing down, as a spiritual mechanism, which I think is enlightening. Because you said, I believe you said, anyway, this is what my notes said.
No, I did say.
Not only light and consciousness will be radiating from the Mahamandir, but also the means of realizing them for each individual, the truth light.
Yes, it can be that. It can be that. But that mention about the links with the various levels of consciousness, I think it will be unnecessary complicating matters there.
Uh-huh.
That sentence you can remove.
Embodiment has been to us here, the full-fledged Mahamandir will be to the whole of humanity.
Yes.
Not only the truth, light, and consciousness will be radiating from the Mahamandir, but also the means of realizing them.
But wait, it is incomplete. You'll read it, but the means of realizing them, what is it? Kindly read, but also, not only light and
not
consciousness.
Not only the truth, light, and consciousness will be radiating from the Mahamandir, but also the means of realizing them for each individual. That would be the spiritual mechanism.
Will be made living to each individual. The means of realizing them. Is that right? Is it clear? Is it clear? The links. Light and consciousness will be radiating from the Mahamandir, but the means of realizing them will remain dynamic. The passage of time, they get encrusted and they lose their original force. But Matrimandir, being what it is, what she has designed, they will retain their dynamism. Yes, please. Next step in the yoga, if you mean the yoga of evolving earth consciousness, is that right? There is a thing like individual yoga, my yoga and her yoga or anybody's yoga. Mother was doing a yoga for earth in evolution. She constituted herself as a representative of the evolutionary cosmic being and was pursuing a process, working out a process of transformation. She has brought it to a certain point. It has to be continued and it will be continued. As far as it can be furthered on higher levels, that is being done. But that part of it which has to be done on earth, another manifestation will have to come and continue it. Can't say. As I visualize, it will be a another new being in a body made there that will manifest. And will complete the process. Beyond what has been done now, it is not possible to do in a normally born human body. I do believe. What Mother and Shrinda called the intermediate race, something like that will have to appear before the supramental body proper can manifest itself on earth. An intermediate stage has to be worked out. I do believe that, though I can't have a precise formulation in my mind yet, what form it will take. It was hoped that this human body would transmute itself into that bridge body. That highly satirized body, which would form the transitional link between the human and the supramental. But things had to stop before that took place. I don't think this is comes in the spiritistic phenomena. There are photographs I have seen in certain books of Leadbeater and Blavatsky, where vague outlines of the spirits and spirits have been captured. See, I think that is quite different. That plane, bordering on the physical plane, almost the subtle physical, which can be photographed by very sensitive films, which is different from the higher levels of which we speak at this time, the supramental or the intermediate rays. I think those levels are different. Those levels belong to the astral plane, which is the lower cycle. For instance, beings of light who are helping the cosmic evolution, whom the subtle eye or the awakened psychic eye can see. But those forms are quite different, those figures are different than the forms and figures of the spirits which come in the mediumistic senses. One needs to have a shift of consciousness to see those forms of light. First came, I believe it was 1937, when I was 19, and I was standing on the terrace to see mother walking on her terrace. My teacher was standing by my side. He asked me, "Say, what do you see?" I said, "Mother is walking." "What else do you see?" I said, "She has put on a gown and she is walking. You don't see anything else?" I said, "No." Then he just touched me. "Look," he said. Immediately I saw the aura around her. And continuously as she was walking, the whole, that bluish, envelope-like thing right from the toe to the top, some inches above, it was walking along with her. So that is what I call a shift of consciousness, whether natural or induced, that is necessary to perceive these higher forms of light. Universal?
Reversal
of consciousness. Yes, yes.
It seems that when some part of us that's not very conscious is touched by the force, there is a reversal of consciousness. And it seems like a very valuable thing to have it happen. So that if you could say more about
reversal comes at the end of a long period of effort. A long effort has to go on by will, aspiration to change, invoking the higher grace and help. And it is when things are ready, that when we least expect, that we find there is a sudden change in the very poise, in the very direction of consciousness. That is called the reversal of consciousness, which is the end of a process. So the process, everybody knows we have to do it. It is a long process. There can also be temporary reversals. Reversal, it stays for some time, then again it goes back to its original position. It is a conversion of consciousness that is permanent. A number of reversals of consciousness ultimately settle themselves into the conversion of consciousness. Once the conversion of consciousness is effected, there is no going back.